Hey, I'm Josie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Josie.
And I am so excited about the speaker we have tonight. She's my aunt, Molly, from Arizona. Molly was always the fun aunt, you know, that would come in town, and we never knew what part of the world she was traveling to or whatever, and come back with her crazy stories and everything. But she, I think, knew about me before I did, you know, as far as she'd come to visit and everything. But she's always been there for me. And she's amazing in this program. The stuff she does for the, she'll explain what she does for the young people, but she's truly amazing. I don't know what I'd do without her.
You can set your timers because I'm just going to stand up here and cry. That was so great. Yeah. That one day a week I put on mascara. Here we are. So hi everyone, I'm Molly. I'm an alcoholic. Set my countdown timer. Thank you, Josie. That was awesome. I was going to be kind of serious, but this is serious, actually, but it's also pretty amazing. Thanks, everybody, for making me feel so welcome. I mean, last night, Tom came to dinner with us, and we've had Buzz and Daryl kicking things off, and Marianne doing the readings, and it's wonderful. I've been to meetings in many countries, as Josie was talking about, and I got sober in 1983. My sobriety date is August 18th, 1983, and you can do the math on that. But I, you know, Josie was talking about, like, I knew what was going on before she knew what was going on in our family, but, you know, we grew up in Arizona, and in my family, I don't know how many of you have, you know, relatives that were affected by, you know, drugs and alcohol or this disease, but it wasn't really a thing to notice how messed up people were. It was just part of being Irish Catholic. You know, they were just interesting, and sometimes they disappear for a couple of years. They would come back and take the kids somewhere. And but what happened in our family was that my mother, Josie's grandma, had two sisters who were both very serious alcoholics. One would, you know, was agoraphobic, would hardly leave her home, and it was just sort of like it sort of just got absorbed into the family system, and people didn't really talk about it too much, or almost at all. And then the other sister was, you know, owned and ran a bar in Cave Creek, Arizona. Cowboy bar. And they had, it was like awesome. She was a great storyteller. She's always on the bar stool. They had a donkey that could drink beer. You know, you could give it a bottle of beer and he'd raise it up and he'd drink beer and he'd get kind of, you know, make an ass out of himself, you know, by the end of the night. He's like ee-hawing and stumbling around, and people thought that was really funny. And but it was, it just kind of was part of the family. But it got worse, you know, through the generations, and it really hit the women in our family. And my mom seemed to do pretty well with being a workaholic, and she would kind of manage. She didn't seem to get too far out of hand with the alcohol. But those other two aunts, they both had daughters, and those daughters are dead from drugs and alcohol. We got three cousins out there that aren't here, you know. And that mostly driving off cliffs and stuff, you know, that kind of thing, or falling off a boat in the middle of the night, loaded. And people didn't really talk about what happened to them either. We weren't connecting all the dots. So, but I was paying attention to this because when I was pretty young, I started out with my sort of alcoholic, you know, alcoholism is, you know, it's really not about the alcohol. Well, it is, and then it's not. But it's about obsessive thinking. It's about, like, think about things you can't stop doing. And you have anxiety in the family, and pretty soon there are lots of things you can't stop doing that you're trying to do to get over not having to feel. But, you know, I started out with an eating disorder at a pretty early age, probably 13 or 14. And I couldn't stop that. That was a problem for me, and that was a real monkey on my back. And we didn't talk about those things, and didn't really, when you don't talk about things, you think you're the only one that's kind of got that problem, and you're going to try to figure it out on your own, and or just use it in some ways to cope. And then, but as it, you know, and as I got to be a teenager and started drinking a little bit, drinking was, to me, some kind of switch flip that things change. Like, I'm one of those people that, you know, after the first drink, things were different. You know, I am that person who, once I have one drink, it came to this anyway, once I have one drink, all bets are off. You know, I don't know what's going to happen next. And I'm kind of a control freak, so that was terrifying to me. I really didn't want to have a day or an evening or a week or a month where I didn't know what was going on. That was terrifying. And so my use really took off around drugs, around speed. So I'm one of those people that was like, I said this to Josie, coming here, like, one of my mottos has been, you know, anything worth doing is worth overdoing. Right? If you're going to, go hard or go home, you know. So it was for me that thing that was an accelerant in my life. And I used alcohol to kind of be able to sleep, to kind of stop. That's what it was for me. It was sort of the breaks. And that was, you know, I realized, like, by the time I was in college, and I was pretty steadily using, you know, some kind of speed to kind of just drive, just crank through the day. I had a job, you know, almost a full-time job, working at a mental hospital and going to college. And I was carrying a full load and, you know, working, and That was kind of the legacy of the family, was, you know, just go hard. And it was getting pretty clear to me that I was, something was wrong. You know, I don't know how many of you had a suspicion at some point that maybe you were crazy. Yeah, so I thought, bunch of hands go up there. But I thought, I'm not sure if I'm crazy, but something's wrong. Something's fundamentally wrong with me. I don't know what it is, and I'm not sure I want to know what it is either. But I'm afraid to stop, because all of that behavior, you know, gave me a kind of energy and a sort of momentum about, like, I am a problem to solve, or the world is a problem to solve, and I'm going to have to, you know, I have to kind of make up for the mess up that I felt like inside. If people really got to know me, they'd be like, you're too big a mess. You know, like, yikes, let's get out of here. So I think that was kind of what I thought was my big problem. And the drugs and the alcohol and the other behaviors were sort of a solution to that problem. And I couldn't really imagine what to do if I'm not going to drink, if I'm not going to use, what am I going to do, right? And I imagine that here in this room too, there's plenty of people who are like, you know, there's a lot of my thought time in my life and my social relations and my connection and the part I like about myself that's associated with those, with drinking or with using. And I don't know who I'm going to be if I'm not doing that. And the trick is, or the thing is that you can't really know until you stop. Like, that's one of my, you know, first sort of blinding flash of the obvious, you know. It's like, oh, I'm not going to figure this thing out until I stop running somehow. But I, you know, I had all that going on inside, and growing up in Arizona, I have three older brothers. One of them is Josie's dad. And when I was, as an undergrad in college, I had somebody on my floor at my university who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not a very intensely practicing member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but one day she asked me to take her to a meeting because she had lost her driver's license. And I had no idea about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I said, sure, I'll take you to a meeting. I was a psychology student, you know, so I'm always curious about everything. So I went with her to this meeting, and she went and sat with her friends, and I kind of sat in the back and just listened. And I'm sitting there, I'm 18 years old, I'm studying psychology, I have an eating disorder that I can't control, I'm taking amphetamines every day. Drinking is pretty scary stuff when it happens for me. And I'm sitting in an AA meeting for the first time. And I'm listening. And I'm like fascinated because it's the first time in my life I've heard people actually speaking from the heart, telling the truth, talking about things that were embarrassing or shameful, that how they felt. And I related so much. I related with eating. I related with so many parts of my life, but I couldn't. It was just like, wow. Like, I think, you know, I feel so connected here. Like, this feels kind of like home to me. And it was like something opened up in my mind. And it was the first time I had that experience ever of really that sense of connectedness instead of disconnection and isolation. And it was powerful because I thought, yeah, wow, these people are so impressive. How is it they're all in one room? You know, like, wow, that's great. I didn't at that point connect like I could do that too. That wasn't really my thought. It was like my stuff was like way too buried down there to be able to say it out loud, you know, but it was the beginning and it planted a seed. And, so I really thought that my sort of my issues were kind of off to the side, tucked in a corner someplace, that it was something I was ashamed of, it drove me kind of crazy, but it wasn't too big a deal yet, you know? And I thought that I could solve that sort of problem by a kind of spiritual awakening. So I was really kind of shooting for going from the first step because I realized I was pretty powerless. So like I had no control over certain parts of my life. And I thought that if I could just have a spiritual awakening, it would fix it. So I was kind of interested in what I would come to think of as a two-step program. You know, because this is really time-consuming. It's kind of messy. You got to talk to people and say things out loud that make them more real, and that, like, couldn't we just, you know, skip that part? Because I don't know how many of you have thought, you know, why do I have to do a fourth step? I don't know if some of you have dragged your feet around a fourth step and a fifth step, thinking, you know what, God already knows that stuff. Why do I have to burden someone else? And it's not going to change anything, you know, that. So some of that was a little bit of what I was thinking. But what I realized later is it was hard. It was just hard to look at it. But I did a degree in psychology at Arizona State University, and I was really, really interested in the mind and how the mind worked. And I had my first job in college was I'd lied about my age and I frosted my hair. We kind of have a hair thing. And I'd gotten this job in a mental hospital in the maximum security ward of a private mental hospital handing out meds. Later I came to think, I never took anybody else's meds, why not, But I didn't, but I was really, really interested. As a 17 and 18 year old, I saw people detoxing and I saw them seeing things that I couldn't see. Stuff's crawling up the wall, coming at them. The mind in a chemical imbalance is very creative. All the unconscious is getting projected onto the world, And I could see that their eyes were dilated, blood pressure's gone through the ceiling, their heart's pounding, and I was amazed by that. I was amazed that they were seeing something that I couldn't see. And it was not a shared reality, but it was a very much a reality for them. And I'd be driving my little Volkswagen home at night and I'd be thinking, what am I seeing? What is this? What's real here? That whole, that's kind of a 20-year-old question you start to ask yourself when you're 20 and 30 and maybe when you're 60. Like, what's really real? And how much of this am I just like projecting my stuff onto the world? And, that's like that great esoteric quantum mechanics kind of thing. If you take enough acid, you get there. You think about those things, or maybe you don't have to do that, but you can. But there's, at some point, we begin to, at least for me, I began to question, like, what's really going on? What's behind the matrix, And that got to be very interesting to me, and I wanted to understand more about not just my mind, but how the mind works and how perception works. I was very interested in all that because it was clear to me that people's inner consciousness changed the way they perceive the world. And so I read my junior year, I got lucky and I got to go around the world on a ship as a student, the World Campus Afloat. And I visited a bunch of countries and it sort of blew my mind, right? And I came back from that, I had 1 year left to go, and all I wanted to do was travel because it just blew the doors off for me. It's like opened my mind so much. And I was still kind of in trouble, of course, but now there was way more interesting stuff out there. And I had destroyed my life. But I was super interested in everything else. And I really fell in love with Japan. So we spent some time in Japan. And when I came back, I finished up my senior year and I went back to Japan. Well, just before that, I read Aldous Huxley's Perennial Philosophy. I read a bunch of things, but Huxley talked about various spiritual paths. And at the end, he said, I think Zen is the way to go because you don't have to believe anything new. It's mostly about like letting go of stuff and having a direct experience of something. And that really spoke to me. And I really felt like I had sort of this problem to solve. And I wanted to understand what's behind, what's real. And I thought the way to do that was to, go away somewhere else and let everything go. And I thought maybe that would help. So I went back to Japan, and I was 22. And I was really interested in studying Zen. I didn't have any idea what I was getting myself into. It was just like this idea, And I went to this Zen monastery in Kyoto, and I had this family that I'd met, and I could stay with them for a few weeks until I figured out where I was going to live. But I went to this big Zen temple called Daitokuji. Maybe some of you have been there in Kyoto. And there was this sort of famous Zen guy there, Kobori Roshi. And there were a few, handful of foreigners. And anyway, afterwards I asked him, I said, you know, I'd like to study Zen and practice meditation. You know, could I practice here? Could I do that here? And he's like, how old are you? And I said, 22. And he said, well, how long do you think you're going to stay? And I said, well, I don't know, maybe a year. And he's like, oh, that's excellent. Most people want to stay for 3 weeks, you know, and, you know, come and get enlightened on their vacation and go. And I said, no, I you know, maybe a year. And he said, well, good. And he actually sent me up to this little temple up on the mountain. And just before I went up there, he said, well, just a piece of advice, Molly, if you're going to do this. He's like, you know, Zen isn't for everybody. And just like we might say, AA is not for everyone, right? But he said, just try it for 10 years, and if you don't like it, try something else. I was like, yeah. Nope. 10 years, that's great, okay. So anyway, I ended up spending 3 years in Japan in that little temple up on the mountain, and we did a lot of meditation. We averaged about 7 hours a day for, you know, 3 years. And it was, you know, a really powerful experience for me, without a doubt. I didn't have any idea what I was getting myself into. The primary thing I didn't know was that if you sit still on a black cushion facing a wall with a bunch of guys with their heads shaved around you for 50 minutes, 14 times in a single day, and then do that for 5 days, which is the kind of thing we would do, that it is excruciatingly painful, like physically painful. You know, everything starts to hurt. So, you know, so this, like, and then if you have nitro coffee from Starbucks and sit still, you're screwed. You know? every thought you've had is now on, you know, in the fast lane, and every conversation that you wish you'd said differently is all now replaying itself. All of that, and then it ends up in your neck and in your back and in your knee. So I had this direct experience of thoughts affecting my body and learning how to kind of calm that down, but it could take a long, long, long time. But anyway, what I want to get to with that was simply that I spent a significant amount of time holding still and trying to kind of get struck sober, if you will. But I would get up off my black cushion and, you know, I was teaching English and doing other things too, but I still had me. And as much as things were better and more present for me, without a doubt, I still hadn't done, like, these other steps, as it turns out. And so when I came back to the States, and I came back and ultimately ended up coming into the rooms, and the reason I kind of came back in, or really started when I got back, is that I was really struggling with the eating disorder, with just obsessive thinking, with alcohol. It got to be that all bets were off. I truly got so that I would end up really doing things that could have cost me a job, that could have cost me other things, and it was very dicey. And I had cousins who were dying of drugs and alcohol. And the handwriting was on the wall for me. And I felt like, look, I'm smart enough to see what's coming. And it's not pretty. And that I need to do something different. And I was really willing to kind of come in the rooms and let the program begin to kind of peel away. Kind of peel away whatever I thought I needed, you know, that I was sort of protective for me. I had to ease into it because it took me a long time to actually get honest and to have a sponsor that I really got completely honest with, where I did a real thorough fourth and fifth step. It took me a while to do that. But it was, you know, I came back from Japan and I could speak pretty good Japanese, and I had studied Chinese in high school, and I went to work for Pan Am as a Japanese-speaking flight attendant, and I got into the rooms, and I started to fly around all over the world, and I was sober, you know, and I had some experiences where, and I wasn't sober when I first started flying, but pretty quickly, you know, if you're gonna fly a charter trip into Dublin and your name is Molly McGinn and you're not sober, you're in trouble, you know, because on St. Patrick's Day when you land in Dublin and your name's Molly McGinn, all bets are off, you know. And but so my experiences around like how close it got for me trying to drink and fly didn't really work, and that was when I really came into the rooms. And I got sober in New York. And I went into my first meeting. I'd been on a flight someplace and it had been really bad. I think we had been to Warsaw, and you know, like it was, vodka was practically free. And I came back from that trip and I went to a meeting on Long Island. And I sat there, and this guy comes up to me, and it's like Frank O'Neill. He's like, "What are you doing here? Who are you? You're new. I haven't seen your face before." I'm like, "Yeah, my name's Molly." He says, "Well, good, Molly, you're in the right place. Sit down, you know. Go, you know, help clean up." You know, he was just like telling me what to do. And I, you know, Frank O'Neill worked for the Long Island Railroad, and he like worked nights for Long Island Railroad, And I didn't have really any idea sort of what the rules were around AA. And he said, "Look, I'm going to pick you up. I'm going to bring you to a meeting. You're going to do at least 3 meetings a week. And then, you know, you go find yourself a sponsor." And he was just, he's like, you know, so Frank was kind of my Eskimo, really. Even though I'd come into the rooms, but he was the one who just, like, told me what to do. And I needed somebody to tell me what to do in the beginning. I needed somebody to say hello to people, thank the speaker, make coffee, clean up, you know, put the cigarette butts out, you know, like that. He was great. And he was the one who would say, you know, "Look, I know you got this fancy job." At that point, that job was kind of a fancy job. "Got this fancy job, but don't think you're smarter than everybody else here, you know. Like, you got to put that aside, you know, otherwise you're not going to learn anything, you know." It was great. So I got in the rooms then, and then I had that experience of actually living the same life, living in the same place, doing this pretty amazing job, and starting to have a very different feeling. Got a sponsor, started to work steps the best I could, and things started to change. And the thing that I was looking for, you know, in that Zen monastery, you know, started to happen, because what I really wanted was freedom. I was really looking for freedom, for mental freedom, because I couldn't sit down and read, you know, read a book, or couldn't read something for 15 or 20 minutes. I was so squirrely, and I just needed, you know, to be moving all the time. And I really wanted access to, like, all my capabilities. And it started little by little to happen. And ultimately, you know, that was really fabulous for me, because that was the beginning of real recovery for me. So I, you know, I flew. I was flying all over the world. I had a flight. I was just talking about this the other day, but we were on a flight, I think, into Hawaii. It was New York to Hawaii, and I was working as a flight attendant in the back cabin. And it was a night flight, and there was this guy who was keep coming back into the galley, and he'd like, "We'll get another drink." He'd like, "Let me have another scotch and soda." And I'm, you know, I don't know what I've got, maybe a year or so at that point, and nobody else is around, and he's got like coat and tie on. And I said to him, "Can I ask you something?" Because I was like pouring in his third drink or his fourth drink. And I said, can I ask you something?" He's like, "Yeah, sure, what?" You know, and I'm like, "How come you're drinking so much? You know, what?" I just somehow, you know, he's like,
That's what I'm trying to figure out. Well, that's part of it. I'm like, excellent. And I said, what's going on? And he said, well, I'm a lawyer. My firm just put me on a leave of absence and sent me to Hawaii to figure out how to fix this drinking problem. I'm like, all right. We're off to a good start. I was so cheeky, you know. And I said, what do you... You know, I knew enough. So we were connecting. He's a smart guy. You know, he could handle my cheekiness. And I said, what have you done so far to try to stop? And he said, or I asked him, like, have you tried to stop? And he's like, yeah. Yep, I have. He's like, I said, what got you to try to stop? And he's like, oh, I really screwed up this thing. And then he was drunk enough that he was just talking, you know. And he like, then I missed this other meeting. And, you know, and so it sounds like there's been some pretty good consequences from this. And he tried to stop. This is like motivational interviewing 101. I'm like, okay. I'm like, well, how much... So is this a primary thing on your mind right now? And he's like, that's why I'm coming to Hawaii. I'm like, all right. I'm like, well, do you want to actually try to stop? And rather than figure out how to stop, how much is, you know, why do you, like, have you ever been to a 12-step meeting? He said, no, I'm not that bad. And I'm like, okay. Well, what if you were that bad? You know? And he's like, anyway, I said, look, when we get off this plane, I said, where are you staying? Because if you want to stop, I'm going to pick you up in the morning for a meeting because I'm clean, you know, I'm sober myself. And there's a meeting right up near the Alamont, whatever it was, and I'll come grab you and we'll go to that meeting. And he said, are you serious? I said, yeah, absolutely. And we did that. In the morning, I got we were two hotels down, picked him up, took him to the meeting. I couldn't believe it because I thought he was going to, like, cower in the corner. People are like, is anybody here for the first time? He raises his hand, and he stands up, and he's like, I can't stop drinking. And everybody's like, yay! He's like, I'm going to lose my job if I don't stop drinking. And they're like, yay! Well, okay. And I was like, I'm amazed. This guy was, like, you know, totally crying. A year later, I get a postcard. Oh, like, they got my year chip, and you know, it was so cool. So, you know, everything started to change for me when I get into the program, and I've got, you know, lots of like exotic other stories. As Josie was saying, I lived all over the world, and I went off to China with my husband. We taught at the Academy of Sciences in Sichuan Province for a year and a half. We were the first people to live in Tibet. After the Chinese had gone in, we spent 4 months traveling all over the interior of Tibet and helping to negotiate for the release of monks out of monastery, you know, like all this cool exotic stuff. And I worked at the International Monetary Fund for 5 years doing conflict resolution work with the economists. So I got to do a bunch of languages and travel many places. I ultimately did a master's and a PhD in cultural anthropology at UCLA, and I did my my research, and my interest has been in transformational communities, right? No big surprise about that, but my research has been in monasteries in Tibet and Japan and Siberia, and ultimately, I got lots of interesting work, global work. But I got very interested in young people in recovery and what recovery creates as a possibility for a life worth really living, a life of extraordinary contribution. And so about 8 years ago, along with a really wonderful group of people, we started a community for young adults in recovery to go to college. And it's an academic community in Prescott, Arizona. That's where young people can live together and go to various they go to various colleges. One at ASU, actually, where my youth really took off. I think it's kind of an immense thing. And
and one in Prescott, and then we helped one get going in Chicago. So now what I'm up to is really helping, you know, young people that are have struggled with substance use, maybe they've been to treatment or wilderness or living in their parents' basement playing video games and smoking weed and for a couple of years, and to kind of come out of there, get support, and get back into school or start school. And it turns out, like, I didn't really know this, but it turns out that when we get a chance to get support and we work the steps and we begin to apply ourselves and kind of dig out of the shame, whole new possibilities come around. There's a whole new level of creativity that becomes possible. And it was interesting. Somebody, one of my early sponsors, said to me, "Molly, you know about the story of Medusa, right? Snake-haired, you know, Gorgon, the woman, and Perseus. You can't look at addiction straight in the eyes because it freezes you, turn to stone. That's the myth, right? If you look at her, she turns you to stone. But Perseus had a mirrored sword, and he looked at her through the mirror and cut off her head. And out of that, when the addiction was cut off, out of her head came the head of Pegasus, the horse who represents creativity. So when the addiction is dealt with and begins to relieve, all this new space and all this new energy can be possible." And I thought, it's so true. It's so true. If all these, you know, if we have the level of kind of support and connection and feel like we're a part of something and not just on our own, it becomes less about me. So that the self, little s, you know, kind of disappears and the bigger s arrives. So we're, you know, connected. It's a big deal. And it turns out that what we've seen now is for young people who thought they had completely broken their brains and had messed up their lives and were never going to amount to anything, blah, blah, blah. They're actually at the top quarter of their classes. They're killing it. And almost to a person. It's just awesome. So that's what I've been up to in the last, 8 years, and helping to work, you know, at a national level, local level, working with parents, working with kids. And we go to Tibet every May. So we're leaving with 11 kids, you know, on May 13th to go stay in his Tibetan monastery up in the mountains for a couple of weeks and, you know, blow their minds to a new level. But I think that's, for me, that the 12 steps is a transformational, transcendent program. It has a deep spiritual roots that allow for a limitless expansion. Part of the promises in the book. So I thought, well, let's do that. Let's create that possibility. Because if we're saying that we've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps and we're going to carry this message, we can do almost anything. And that the world needs us, you know, to help bring those possibilities into life. And the past, you know, this is a transformation from the past to the future by being in the present moment and letting go and not having to live within the fears and the bounds of our past. And my early sponsors had me make a list of my fears and really, really look at those in the light of a kind of spirituality and start to let that go, because they're just not true. They're beliefs based on beliefs that just aren't true. And she also had me make a list of my rules. Like, she's like, you're running a lot of rules, girl. And I had this long list. And she's like, now cross out all the ones that aren't helpful. And that was part of that transformative experience for me. And so I think that's... I think the legacy of this program, it was based on... You know, I think Bill Wilson had a profound spiritual experience and really pass that on. And that this is, that's something that happens in these rooms because of you and us together, that the wisdom of the runes and the wisdom of that experience gets shared at a level that is, you know, deep in the cells, deep in the unconscious. You've probably heard this, he said that sometimes just coming to a meeting and sitting there and listening, somebody said it's like the laying on of the ears, you know? Yeah, like just listening. We learn by osmosis. You bring your ass and put it in a chair. That's the message I heard. But there is, you know, everyone here has their own path, but it's part of the shared learning that really has been transformative for me. And I think I'm just about out of time here. Let's see if my timer went off. Oh, I have 45 more seconds. I'll stop. But I want to thank you all for being here tonight. I'm not sure how this went over, but nobody threw anything at me. Yeah. So it's an honor, you know, and I want to thank you for having the guts to come here to tell the truth, to hear the truth, to take care of Josie, to change, because change is hard. There's people all around us that aren't willing to do that, and it's Groundhog's Day every day. And that was what my life got like, and now it is an unfolding mystery of amazing, amazing change that's happening every day. So I'm going to stop there and turn it back over to Daryl. Does this go back to Daryl?
Sure.
Yeah.